Blog Talk Radio.
Well, your dadgum government, you saw so and so's. You got your damn hands in every pocket of my clothes. Well, your dadgum government. Oh, don't you know? Oh, don't you love them sometimes? Well, your dadgum government, you better pay attention. You're setting up there like a fool's convention. Will you dat-gum government?
Well, welcome to Handling the Truth. This is Terry Dodd. I'm here with my co-host, Mike Gaddy. And we are excited tonight because we've got a special guest, a recurring guest here on Handling the Truth, Dave Scorpio. Welcome back, Dave.
Well, Terry and Mike, thanks for having me on. I'm really looking forward to our conversation tonight.
Well, Mike started us out a couple of weeks ago, actually, talking about how we cannot get organized to resist the tyranny that's going on because they've got us so divided. And I had asked Mike about how did the Federalists divide their opposition back at the time of the founding. And Mike suggested that we talk about the fake news of 1787, and I thought that was an awesome topic and really so relevant to what we're looking at today. Mike, you want to say hello before I open us with a prayer?
Hi, guys. Hey, great to be with you two tonight.
It's always good to have you here, Mike, and I'm looking forward to another good lesson tonight. But let's pray first and get this started right. El Shaddai, Yahweh Almighty, you created it all, and we're just pleased that we know who's going to be the final victor in the battle, the spiritual battle that's going on, Father, and we're just glad that we can turn to you, and that you'll help us see the truth around us, and that's what we ask tonight. We just ask, as always, that you help us handle the truth tonight and to put it out in a way that people will understand what's really happening and going on. But Father, this division, even amongst those that profess your name and profess the name of your Son, seems so divided, and it seems so easy to divide people. So we're going to talk about that division tonight, Father, and we pray that you would give us wisdom about it and help us to not just understand it, but to also get a plan as to how we can go forward and help people to overcome the divisions amongst the people, that we can take on and resist the tyranny, the evil that we're facing in the United States and all over the globe. So, Father, we rely upon you, we trust in you, we trust in your Spirit, and we invite you to be a part of what we're talking about tonight. And it's in the name of your Son, our Savior, our King, Yahshua HaMashiach, we pray. Amen. Well, Mike, you you brought out some interesting stuff when we were having a private conversation here a few days, and I'm really glad Dave's able to join us tonight, but I'm going to turn the floor over to you and let you go at it.
All right, Terry, thanks a lot. Getting back, I stopped and think about how I was taught, and and I think it's still being taught along those lines today, and it is terribly deceptive the way that we have been taught about the founding era of this country. We are told that the Articles of Confederation were so weak, they wouldn't work, they couldn't get this done, they couldn't get that done, all of this other stuff. And so the people that we call Federalists, which are really nationalists bordering on monarchists, decided all the way back in 1785 in a meeting at Mount Vernon that they needed to get rid of the Articles of Confederation because of Article 2 and Article 13, which were terribly restrictive on the growth of government. And so to be able to do what they wanted to do to accomplish their goals, they knew they had to do something about it. So they started back then. As a matter of fact, even before then, Alexander Hamilton in New York had asked the New York State Legislature to push to overhaul or get rid of the Articles of Confederation. And there was no outcry among the people for it. So they realized that if we're going to have to gin up a reason for acceptance, we're going to have to do it ourselves. So they started with in 1785, and then in 1786 they had the Annapolis Convention, and they had that to work on commerce, to get things flowing well and to cure the problems with the Articles. The problem was is they had it in Annapolis, Maryland, and only five states sent representatives out of 13. And as it would, the funny part is Maryland didn't even send delegates, and the convention was in Maryland. So then they decided, especially Alexander Hamilton and James Madison, they decided if we are going to get this thing done, we're going to have to get George Washington involved in it, because the people will rally around Washington. They're not rallying around us. We're going to have to get Washington involved. So Madison, Hamilton start writing, and John Jay start writing to Washington, asking him to be a delegate. And he says, no, I want out. I'm tired. I just want to go back. I want to run my plantation. I don't want to get involved in all this. And of course, Forrest McDonald says the one way to approach Washington was through his ego. And then they got Generals Lincoln and I'm trying to think of the other one. They got two generals that had been very close to Washington. And they got these two generals to start writing to him. And then when the Shays Rebellion comes along, and of course, Shays Rebellion, as we are taught, is a distortion and is almost, a patent lie of how they, but the generals were able to use that. Knox, and that's who it was, Knox and Lincoln wrote to Washington, oh, we've got to do something. If we don't, the country's going to come apart at the seams, all this stuff. Well, they also knew if you're going to rally support, you're going to have to get the news media behind you. And so they went to the major newspapers. Well, by 1787, there were about 95 newspapers in the United States total. And all of those, or almost all of those, 95 to 98% were all in the major metropolitan areas. There were no papers out in rural America at that time. And, occasionally one would get out there by a courier or, would get out there by boat or something like that. A paper would get out. But majority of the people out there were concerned about making a living. They didn't need to have news that often. And so the news was centered in the metropolitan areas. The problem being, again, is that about 95% of the population of this country in 1786, 1787 was in rural parts of the country where there was no newspapers. So that created, the fact that they said that there was a clamoring among the people for a change in the Constitution is an out-and-out distortion of the truth. Because the people of the country back then weren't complaining about a darn thing except trying to make a living after the war. It was the merchants and the wealthy aristocracy that was worried about changing government so that they could tax the people improvements that they wanted. But then they made it out to be as if, the whole country was clamoring for change, which is, a patent falsehood. But they did that with the newspapers. And ironically, about 5 months before the, you know, maybe about the beginning of 1787, these newspapers who had been saying how weak, and they kept doing it, they kept writing, we've got to do something. These the conditions are terrible. We've got to have a new government. You know, the articles are too weak. We've got to have something. And so that was able to promote among the city areas. Now let's stop and think about that. Philadelphia was the largest city in the country at that time, largest population. Delegates to the Constitutional Convention from the state of Pennsylvania, all eight of them were from Philadelphia. So you can't say that the rural part of Pennsylvania was represented. And actually, the rural parts of no states were represented. It is highly believable that the majority of the people in this country didn't even know there was a constitutional convention going on. Because there certainly was nothing like CNN or all this other stuff we have now 24 hours a day on the lobotomy box. It just wasn't happening. But ironically, these same newspapers that pushed so hard against the Articles of Confederation, while the convention was going on in the summer of 1787, started pushing for ratification of, they didn't even know what was in it. So Nancy Pelosi is not new with her idea of let's pass it and find out what's in it. They were pushing for adaption, a ratification of the Constitution before it was ever even finished. So the same newspapers carried a very heavy influence at that time. So then, you know, let's look at, I think a great part of this is, as we refer to it so many times, is freedom of the press. And, the press was the mass medium of the 18th century. You know, naturally we had no TV or anything, and was the only way to bring forth news and commentary to anything like a broad spectrum of the population. The popularity of newspapers soared in revolutionary America. By the late 1780s, the United States, as I said before, had about 95 newspapers, over twice the number that they had in 1776. Moreover, the newspapers of 1776 were weekly newspapers, but those of 1787, the year of the convention, were published two to three times a week, and there are even a few that appeared daily to satisfy a metropolitan group of people who were hungry for news. What the newspapers would print for the benefit of the sovereign people during the ratification process was itself the subject of a debate. As I said before, they printed that the Constitution was fine. Publishing commentaries that found fault with it was something else again. Essays on behalf of ratification had no trouble getting printed even before the people knew what was in the Constitution. As I said, already in the summer of 1787, while the Federal Convention labored away in abject secrecy, newspapers carried articles advocating that it be adopted whatever government was proposed. Now, people back then are no different than people today. They read something enough, they hear something enough, they believe it as truth. Now, once the convention adjourned, more essays appeared describing the Constitution and singing its praises. A debate, however, of no matter of the issue, requires two sides. Now, to address your point, Terry, the thing that is so critical here is that we only are getting one side in the press at that time. Articles of Confederation are bad. The new Constitution we haven't even seen is good. This is also an indication. This needs to be understood. The Federalists were organized starting in 1785. There was no opposition organization because people didn't know what they were opposing, and they didn't know what the convention would come out with. But to get criticism of the Constitution into circulation took a few more weeks and a sturdy dose of stubborn courage during that era. Once they got going, the newspaper debates were more than a mere prelude to the more decisive debates in the state ratifying conventions, which were about to begin. They influenced electors who chose delegates to the convention, and they provided those delegates with an array of arguments that they could adopt, perhaps modify, and repeat. So, again, the people had been hearing for months how good the Constitution was before they ever saw it. So we have a mind control program going on there, just like we do now on CNN and MSNBC and Fox News. It's a mind control program. Back then, they were doing it with the newspapers of the day. So any questions so far, gentlemen, or comments?
Go ahead, Dave.
Well, I have a couple of comments. Well, Mike, you know, just listening to your discourse tonight, you know, it really shows what a talent you have for bringing past events to the present, you know, connecting the two things and really making the history come alive. Because once the listener or the viewer can connect these past events with the present, it really helps, you know, show the relevance of what you're talking about. And, you know, I was just thinking about a land without newspapers, what it must have been like to live in a rural area where there were no newspapers. It must have been such a tremendously different state of mind that people were in. But conversely, it also shows the incredible power that newspapers must have had. You know, when you have people who are living in rural areas, essentially disconnected from the rest of the world, the power held by newspapers must have been absolutely tremendous and self-evident to men who are, you know, playing the power game.
Well, that's correct. Any thoughts or observations, Terry?
You know, in the last couple of weeks, I had already pretty much stopped watching the television, except for a couple of things that I was interested in. But here in the last couple of weeks, I've even turned pretty much off to radio, and the difference in the stress level, you know, I've been able to maybe relax just a little bit and recharge, because they keep us at such a fevered pitch. I think it's very unhealthy that we get so caught up in the propaganda and the Hegelian dialectic, even if we know that it's a smokescreen, which I obviously have said many times, the left-right debate is nothing but a smokescreen. But in spite of that, the stress level is just, you don't recognize it till you get away from it a little bit. When you walk away from it and you just don't listen to any of it, you kind of get back to just wanting to live your life. And we haven't been able to do that in the United States for my entire lifetime, I don't believe.
Well, I could not agree more. And again, Dave, that was a very valid point, that the people out there in the hinterlands, if we could call that rural America, where 95% of the population lived, they were concerned with everyday, day-to-day tasks, how to make a living, how to put food on the table, how to, and especially in Massachusetts, how are you going to pay these taxes? And Shays Rebellion was a very much a part of that. So we have to understand that there was a conditioning program going on in the cities at least a year before the convention. They were being gradually conditioned to accept a constitution when it came out, regardless of what was in it. And for those who had been taught and told that the constitution being produced in Philadelphia was the country's only alternative to abject ruin, any opposition to its very quick and immediate ratification was seen as treason. seriously, that was actually put into the papers that if we don't ratify this thing, we need this thing so bad that if it's not ratified right away, if people don't ratify it right away, it's treason. So we have to remember before the people saw the Constitution in Pennsylvania, because Philadelphia was exactly where they had the convention. So when the convention was over, the Pennsylvania legislature took the Constitution, and they were going to vote to ratify it right away without a discussion, without even reading the Constitution. They were going to vote to ratify it. Well, several people who were representatives from Philadelphia who lived in western Pennsylvania, they were not about to go ahead and ratify and adopt something they hadn't seen. But they were told that the next day they would all show up at the convention hall and they would vote to ratify this new, brand new Constitution that, again, they hadn't seen or hadn't read. Kind of like the Patriot Act, if you'll remember that. So here was, and these guys were going, no, we're not going to do that. And so finally they decided the only way we can stop this thing, we don't have enough votes. The only way we can stop this thing from being ratified is to enough of us not show up tomorrow for this convention so that they won't have a quorum so they can't vote. So many of the delegates stayed where they were staying in a hotel or what have you. The next day they just didn't go to the meeting so that they wanted to keep them. I think there were 11 of them. Who said, we're going to make sure there's not a quorum, so this thing can't be voted in without even reading it. So they stayed, and the sergeant of arms was sent to the boarding house to gather these people up, and they actually physically drug some of these people to the meeting hall so that they would have a quorum. Well, fortunately, enough people were incensed, the legislatures in Pennsylvania were incensed that they had to go out and physically beat guys up and carry them into the convention hall, that they voted, no, we're not going to even do a ratification until we see this thing. Well, that violence began to seep out to the public, and the public begins to wonder, even in the metropolitan areas, what is so important about this thing that they're willing to beat each other up to get a vote? So the response to that was people began, and by this time people had seen copies of the Constitution. So the response to the first published criticism of the Constitution in Philadelphia's Freeman's Journal on September 26th. Now remember, the Constitution was signed on September 17th. So this is September 26th, 9 days after the convention was adjourned, we get an idea of what was about to happen. The essay's anonymous author questioned with diffidence parts of the Constitution and admitted that most of his objections were of an inferior magnitude only. He questioned the provision that said the number of representatives shall not exceed one for every 30,000. And he had a couple of other comments about place and times of elections and what have you. He did not like having a new Congress meet in December, and he thought poll taxes should have been outlawed. And he suggested the Constitution should be more specific in describing the size and function of juries in criminal cases, because the right for trial by jury wasn't even in the Constitution to start with. However, the essay acknowledged that our situation is critical, so they're repeating what they heard on the news, just like we hear today. They described the Constitution in general as a well-wrought piece of stuff that promised to ensure the happiness and respectability of the United States. And they concluded on the whole, the Constitution deserves support of all the states. As things would go, these criticisms were very mild, but it provoked a vicious denunciation of this person. And the Independent Gazetteer, whatever you want to pronounce that. And so the Independent Gazetteer says, and I quote, "What in the name of wonder inspired such a daring attack And it said, at this awful crisis, when the fate of America depends on the unanimity of all classes of citizens in support of the Constitution, how could they even begin to criticize this masterpiece? And that's their actual words, this masterpiece of work. And if the name of this guy, if the name of any anti-federalist, as they became to be known, became known, the paper says, they will suffer the just resentment of an incensed people who perhaps may honor him with a coat of tar and feathers. So the newspapers are saying, hey, if you don't like this Constitution, you should be tarred and feathered. Threats like that encouraged writers to continue the standard practice of publishing essays under pseudonyms. Now, we've wondered several times, why did that happen? Why did we have Brutus, the Sentinel, the Whig, the old Whig, the farmer, the federal farmer? Why did we have all of these names? Well, now we know. Because people it was said, if you publish this stuff and we find out who you are, you'll be tarred and feathered if you object to the Constitution. Stop. Today, let's just take a parallel. Are we not seeing the same thing directed toward people who don't want vaccinations? Wearing a mask is ridiculous. And that has been totally influenced by the media.
Even here in my own town, they just went after. They did a witch hunt hit piece article on our new mayor simply because he questioned that narrative, specifically about things like the mask mandate and the COVID, the plandemic, and also about any kind of patriot information supporting Trump. They denigrated our new mayor here in a local advertising rag. It's beyond belief what the people are willing to abdicate to.
Well, and again, I think Dave's point is very relevant here. This is not new. To sway people's emotions to get what they want using the media, using the bully pulpit, as what's his name used to say, we have absolutely washed the minds of people, brainwashed people into these attitudes. But, you know, going back to 1787 in Boston, Benjamin Russell, who was the publisher of the Massachusetts Sentinel, announced in early October, just half a month after the Constitution comes out, he announced that he would print no essays that raised any objection to the Constitution unless the authors left their names to be made public. That would clearly discourage critics of the Constitution from speaking out because they had been said they'd be tarred and feathered. So the local tradesmen and artisans, which back then were called mechanics, strongly supported ratification. They had been worked up into such a degree of rage, one Massachusetts official noted, that it was unsafe to be known to oppose the Constitution in the city of Boston. Draw the parallels, gentlemen. Dave, can you see it?
Oh, absolutely. And, it's amazing how, you know, they've used this power of hatred that they've created through, you know, the demonization of Trump for 4 years, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And they're sort of now moving that hatred that they've created towards someone that doesn't want to wear a mask or doesn't want to get the vaccine. They've really created this momentum of hatred, and they're using it now, sort of metastasizing it into other areas of life, whatever they need. And, you know, the other thing that just strikes home is that, you know, political events and government will always use force and violence to fulfill their agenda. And that seems to be true today as it was when you're talking about these stories.
Okay. Let me move along here, and I agree with you totally, but the Federalist in Boston defended Russell's policy as a way – now listen to this – as a way of making sure that the foreign enemies of the United States were not secretly fomenting fear and discord among the people. Now, since no similar distrust felt on the Federalists who supported the country's happiness and prosperity – by advocating ratification of the Constitution, they could go on writing without divulging their identities. So if you opposed the Constitution and you had been threatened with tarred and feathered, you had to list your name. So do you think this kept some people from writing opposing viewpoints? But if you supported the Constitution, you could do it under a pseudonym. That was no problem. But some people, and, you know, there's always going to be a few out there that have the guts to do it. So other commentators charged Russell with violating freedom of the press since his policy would curtail the range of arguments available to the public. Let's think Facebook, YouTube, Twitter. Can we think of anybody else who has decided that if you have an opposing viewpoint, you have no voice? Things really haven't changed much, have they? Philadelphia, a writer who took the pen name Fair Play. Think about this play of words. They've always been good at this. He answered the threats leveled against those who criticized the Constitution by insisting that the liberty of the press, the great bulwark of all of the liberties of the people, ought never to be restrained. So Fair Play was hitting it on the head. Although, he added, the Honorable Convention did not think fit to make the least declaration in its favor. So here's a guy who's saying that the freedom of the press should not be violated, but he says, but the people at the convention didn't put it in writing. So he was making a negative comment. Hey, you didn't think freedom of the press was important, or you would have put it in your constitution. So again, well, I have to say, for those who don't know, the original Constitution did not have a Bill of Rights. It was voted down unanimously. They did not want a Bill of Rights in the Constitution. So the freedom such writers defended went back to an earlier time in America when colonial printers had to appeal to a broad range of readers to even stay in business. They took a neutral stand and justified necessity by defining a free press as one that was open to all parties. That way of operating came under pressure as the market for newspapers grew and the revolution raised doubts about the wisdom of giving all parties, including those who were loyal to England, ready access to the reading public. So look, a war changed the rules. If you're a student of history, you know the war will always change the rules, and seldom, if ever, do they go back to like they were before the war came along. And the wars always constitute a lack of freedoms that is necessitated by these wars. The divisions during the 1780s made it difficult and sometimes unprofitable for a printer to remain impartial. On the other hand, the establishment of an alleged republic, which all power came from the people, gave the argument for a press open to all parties a new ideological foundation. So the revolution brought some of this back. To exercise their responsibilities intelligently, the citizens of a republic had to be fully informed of different views on public issues. Wow. What if Zuckerberg agreed with that? The concept of a free press, therefore, was different from the standing Anglo-American understanding of freedom of the press, which referred to the freedom of printers to publish whatever they wanted without prior restraint by the government. Printers remain liable to prosecution for licentious uses of their freedom, and liberal defenders of freedom of the press insisted that truth should be a defense. But the emphasis, however, was on the freedom of the press to monitor and criticize persons in power and the policies they adopted. So in 1787, no government actually prevented the publication of essays critical of the Constitution. The problem instead was the city dwellers, from wealthy merchants to rowdy sailors to dock workers and tradesmen and mechanics, almost unanimously favored the Constitution because it supported their livelihood, which meant that you can ensure your trade by taxing other people to make sure they paid for it. The establishment of a new national government with the power and the authority to promote and defend American commerce promised a new prosperity for these men with those particular with that livelihood, because it all depended on trade. Now, here, throw in the other factor that this form, that all of these people who now supported the Constitution, their professions had been severely limited because of the war. So, guys, if you hear a crazy sound, sounds like a typewriter, we are having one heck of a rainstorm on my metal roof. So you guys want to throw anything in there, Terry?
Are you hearing that, Dave? Because I don't hear it.
I hear something, a subtle sound of water. Yeah, absolutely. But it's not bad. It's very subtle.
Okay, I just didn't want to fog up all of the folks out there with that particular problem, if they were going to have problems hearing. So, anyway.
Oh, no, you're loud and clear, Mike.
Okay, good. Glad to hear that. Okay, so let's stop and think about something. If this Constitution was so good, why would you have to lie to sell it? People be love to have it. Why would you have opposition? And again, I think it's critical to know that there were many more anti-Federalists than there were Federalists. But if you get right down to it and you look at Saul Cornell's book and you go to Herbert Storing's book, you will find that the anti-Federalists were not in any way organized. These were independent people, truly independent, freedom-loving people.
They didn't have the bully pulpit of the newspapers either.
Well, they most assuredly did not. But there was one newspaper, guys, and I'm trying to think of the gentleman's name right now, who owned that newspaper. Let me see if I can find it. I think it was one of them was the Freeman's Journal. And here's another thing I think we should touch on before that. When some of these papers would put in an anti-Federalist opposition, point of opposition, then suddenly the people in the city called and started to threaten to cancel their subscriptions to these newspapers. So here we begin to see the influence. Advertisers with money who advertise in those newspapers were saying, hey, if you keep printing this stuff, we're going to pull our advertisements or we're not going to buy the paper. I don't know where that noise is coming from. So the very first criticisms of the Constitution appeared in the Philadelphia, Pennsylvania Freeman's Journal, which proclaimed in its headlines, open to all parties, but influenced by none. That was its banner. So in the spring and early summer of 1787, its publisher was Francis Bailey, and he had written items favoring increasing the powers of the Articles of Confederation. but by late summer, it had become critical of the federal convention. The Freeman's Journal was, in fact, closely aligned with what was called at the time Pennsylvania's Constitutionalist Party. So, also a rival Philadelphia paper, the Independent Gazetteer, also became a major source of essays criticizing the Constitution. Its owner, and I hope I pronounce this name right, I'll spell it for you, E-L-E-A-Z-E-R, Eliezer, Eliezer Oswald, generally spoke for the state's Republican Party, whose members wanted the Constitution ratified quickly and without any changes whatsoever. Oswald was an enemy, a political enemy of one of the other newspapers, and he had even challenged their owner to a duel at one time. And they had the London Coffee House in Philadelphia, which was a favorite meeting place for merchants and their political allies. In August of 1787, before the federal convention adjourned, the Independent Gazetteer had published essays advocating the speedy establishment of a vigorous continental government, which reflected the opinions of its clientele. Similarly, in September, the paper included the piece by Tar and Feathers, the one I mentioned before, that attacked an early criticism of the Constitution. But it seems like Eliezer was a tough and hot-tempered kind of a guy, and he didn't take a challenge very well. And when his old supporters tried to prevent him from publishing any of the anti-federalist articles, he refused to give in. And he had some firm convictions on the role of the press in a free country, and he was not about to let anyone, even his best customers and advertisers, tell him what he could and could not print. And he was an Englishman who had migrated to America at the age of 15. And he learned the printing trade as an apprentice to John Holt, whose newspaper, the New York Journal, had been closely allied with New York's Sons of Liberty in the 1760s and 1770s as well. So later, Oswald was actually a soldier and became a colonel in the Continental Army, originally starting under Colonel John Lamb, who was a prominent New York founder of the Sons of Liberty in New York, and who would later be at the center of his state's opposition to ratification of the Constitution without amendments. Before the Revolutionary War was over, Oswald had gone into business for himself and almost as quickly found himself at the center of the controversy over freedom of the press. In 1782, after his Independent Gazetteer accused the Pennsylvania Supreme Court of bias, the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania, ordered his arrest for publishing a negative critique of the Supreme Court. Can you see why this guy might have leaned toward the free press, guys?
Well,
but the wonderful story, the wonderful part of that story, which I found very interesting, was even though the Supreme Court issued an indictment for him for seditious, scandalous, and infamous libel, the local grand jury would not issue an indictment.
They actually had some intelligent people on a grand jury.
Well, you can see now why the government does not want the people to be involved with the grand jury process unless it is maintained and controlled by the prosecution. But those who wanted to keep any criticism of the Constitution out of the press met their match with Eliezer Oswald. According to one observer, he was the only Philadelphia printer who dared to print the address of the Pennsylvania Assembly's dissenting members. Have either of you gentlemen read that, The Descent of the Minority in Pennsylvania?
No.
No.
Well, I would highly suggest that. As a matter of fact, I'll send it to both of you when the show's over tonight. That is one of the most beautiful addresses against the Constitution written by the minority at the Ratification Convention. And they published their works. Does either one of you gentlemen want to venture a guess as to who the author of that opposition, first day with my new lips, the author of the opposition to the Constitution was?
I'll just take a wild guess and say Patrick Henry.
Well, Patrick Henry Luther. Was in Virginia. This was Pennsylvania. Luther Martin was in Maryland, and this was Pennsylvania. At first, the people thought it was a member of the Supreme Court, and they thought that this member of the Supreme Court had written this dissent of the minority, and they thought it was George Bryan. But it was his 27-year-old son, Samuel Bryan, who would later write as Sentinel.
Oh, wow.
He was only 27. Samuel Bryan was my next guest, by the way.
Okay. Well, so when the supporters of the Constitution threatened to cancel their subscriptions if Eliezer continued to oppose the Constitution and publish such pieces of work, Oswald again refused to cave in, and he said, "You are very welcome to do whatever you would please, but please make sure you come in and settle your accounts first." I love that. Okay. And all of the people in Philadelphia seemed to know that there was no way in the world that Oswald would ever give in to anyone's threats, or they would have proposed some other form of punishment. Now, here, this is critical. Men like Oswald in the cities of America in 1787 were rare. Only 12 of over 90 American newspapers and magazines published anything like a substantial number of essays critical of the Constitution during the entire controversy. 12 of 90. Remember that. I think is very critical.
Well, Mike, this brings me to a question, if I may.
Sure.
Yeah. So, at this time, was the consolidation of ownership of newspapers in play at all, or were these all like really, you know, independently owned papers?
Everything that I can find would be that they were independently owned, although there was something akin to a brotherhood of printers. Not formally, but they all had either learned from one another or had helped the other get started. You know, not in the same city. They would help somebody, like John Lamb helped Eliezer get started in Philadelphia. So they would help in different parts. But so that they weren't competition, but they did have a form of brotherhood.
Right.
And the funny thing here is most of the newspapers of the 12 that would post opposition letters to the Constitution were the same editors who had published articles from the Sons of Liberty. So we begin to see a common thread flowing through.
Right. And you brought up the issue of advertisers, you know, putting pressure upon newspapers. At this time, were most newspapers free, or, you know, or were the ads just to sort of help keep the cost down of the newspapers?
Well, they had, you know, some of them had different prices that they charged for their paper, usually in the 1 to 3 penny range each. And there was another printer, I'm trying to think, Greenleaf, I think was his name. He promised to give, he put in his paper, he would give every performance that may be written with decency free access to my newspaper. So Oswald and Greenleaf suffered verbal attacks, canceled subscription, and threats of mob violence to their business for daring to oppose ratification of the Constitution. So a free press at that time was one that would present the people with due criticism as well as hallelujahs. So interesting is that Oleander Oswald was the guy, the only guy who published all of Sentinel's essays. The New York Journal also published Cato. Now, some of us have read Cato's. And he's the one of the first ones. He wrote the first of seven essays that suggested that the people could propose amendments to the Constitution. Cato inspired an outrage response by the person who wrote as Caesar, who again insisted the country had to accept or reject this Constitution in toto, the damn thing as it is, and just be thankful. But the wonderful part about what Oswald printed was that objections of the minority, it really caught on. And by early November, that which Oleander Oswald had published, The Dissent of the Majority, by early November, that address had been printed 12 times in Pennsylvania, including once as a broadside written in German. It had been published 16 times in another 7 states. By contrast, the first essay by Cato was printed or reprinted only 6 times in 3 states, twice in New York, 3 times in Pennsylvania, and once in Massachusetts. The story of how dissenting members had been dragged to the statehouse, which the address described, accounts for much of that interest. Answers to the address were quick in coming, but they could not kill the public's interest in what the New York Morning Post described as an event perhaps paralleled in any age or country. The political and outrageous fracas in Philadelphia, in consequence of a virtuous minority of the legislature, refused to vote against their conscience. The intemperate and violent measures of the Pennsylvania assemblies suggested, as George Mason had charged, that the Constitution's advocates dreaded, and I quote, a thorough knowledge and public discussion of this subject, and they wanted to get it ratified before it was submitted to, and I quote again, the test of impartial examination. Before long, the Constitution's supporters understood that the Pennsylvania majority's actions were a political mistake, one serious enough to throw the Constitution's fate into serious doubt. So, any questions at this point, gentlemen?
Well, what started this whole conversation basically was a question about how the Federalists kept their opposition divided. And I think you've shared in great detail a source document evidence of exactly how they did it, and they did it primarily through the information flow, which at that point was controlled by the newspapers. And you're saying that only 12 out of the 90 newspapers were
12 out of 91 newspapers printed opposition to the Constitution.
So there was obviously some kind of coordinated effort on the part of this club or clique of journalists in that day Do we know anything about where most of these, how these journalists got their start? I know you said that they helped each other and did that, but I'm just wondering if there was a bankster connection there as well. It seems like for those who want to participate in the bankster narrative, money seems to be not an object for getting yourself funded.
Well, I can't find any connections in writing in any of the source documents about the banker's involvement. I think we would all be idiots to believe that there was none. But as for documenting, to lay it out and say, here's the concrete proof, no. But one thing I think that is critical, and this is something I wanted to get out there so that people would understand that. Before leaving Philadelphia, the founders were sworn to secrecy, and the record of their proceedings of the previous 4 months were tucked away for safekeeping and given to George Washington. The other conspirators, and I do think they were sure no one would have the unmitigated gall to ask Washington to produce these documents. And they were right. And so Washington absolutely did not reveal any of these documents about what went on at the convention for 9 years. Washington had all this information and no one saw it for 9 years. If you did such a great thing, why would you want to hide it from the people? Now, here I would like to quote historian Gary Wills and what he had to say about this, and I think it is very relevant. And he said, and I quote, "At some point, George Washington surely learned what he might have suspected anyway, that Madison planned to arrive in Philadelphia with a plan that moved the adoption of a new government to be adopted by state conventions and not the legislatures. Once that motion was taken up, every delegate would be at odds with his instructions to amend within the guidelines of the articles. And if that step were made known to the public, the delegates would be able to take no others. The debate would be less among themselves than with their foes in public at home in their state legislatures or in the federal Congress. All the procedural fights that did follow on the eventual publication of the draft would have been conducted simultaneously with the debates on further changes to be made. Pledge of secrecy was made and enforced by Washington, and the embarrassing record of the convention's procedures was entrusted at the final session to Washington, who took it to Mount Vernon, where few would dare to challenge him for its surrender. As has often been noted, if that record had come to light at the time of the ratification debates, the Constitution would never have passed. Madison's original plan, with a stronger central government able to veto state laws and a stronger veto on congressional legislation, would have confirmed the worst fears of all the anti-federalists," unquote. As I said before, it would be 9 years before Washington would release these documents for public consumption. Pardon me. But one of the things I think most people don't know is, let's get to another point here. And are you guys at all familiar with Agnes Burke?
A little.
Dave, are you familiar with Agnes
Burke?
Yeah, I've
heard of, yes, a little bit, but not well acquainted, no.
Right.
Okay, he led the opposition in the state of South Carolina. And Agnes Burke, after the whole thing was over, sent a long questionnaire to several people. He sent this questionnaire to, of course, Samuel Bryant. He sent it to Mercy Otis Warren, and he also sent this question to, I'm trying to think of his name now, Elbridge Gerry. He sent that, and he asked them because he wanted to put out a very well-published book on how they were able to do all of this. Now, Mercy Otis Warren responded with her own book on the whole subject, and Samuel Bryan replied, which is included. The problem is Agnes Burke never published this, but it can be found. He didn't publish the book, but it can be found. And so, also, the other thing I wanted to get in, I know we're going to run out of time before I even get close to all of this, but one of the things that really made a difference here that we don't, that hardly is ever mentioned, is the U.S. Postal Service. Now, a lot of these anti-Federalist papers and Federalist papers also had to be sent out, and they had to go out by the Postal Service. And the Postal Service at that time was mostly like stagecoaches or wagons. And that was how the mail traveled back then. But then, of all things, the Postmaster General, Ebenezer Howard, operating at the insistence or maybe even some financial help from the Federalists, changed all of the anti-Federalist papers from the normal routes by stagecoach to private riders, like the Pony Express. The problem was very little of those papers that went by those riders ever arrived at where they were supposed to go. So that became a real, to the Postmaster General's anti-Federalist enemies, the decision was a deliberate attempt to interfere with the traditional prerogatives of printers and obstruct the free flow of political information. Rather than improving the efficiency of the mails, as Ebenezer Howard said would happen when he shifted it to the individual riders, Hazard reforms actually resulted in widespread delays and increased the opportunities for corruption. In many instances, papers were simply thrown away by post riders, even though they collected their money for making the run, or they were sold by individuals. They were sold by these riders to other people. So if you were a Federalist and you didn't want the anti-Federalists to get out, all you had to do was to go to find out who the rider was and go and offer him more money. And then he got paid twice and he didn't have to make the trip. And so one of the upper general said that the Postmaster General was motivated by, and I quote, the advocates of a despotic power who had found their efforts to shackle the press unsuccessful in many of the states. And frustrated in their efforts to stop this in the press, their next step was as much as possible to cut off all communication of sentiment and to prevent any publications from circulating to other states. Sentinel made this allegation. He thus believed that Hazard's actions limited the influence of newspapers to the places of their publication, while falsehood and deception have seen universal circulation without the opportunity of refutation. So what was happening was the Federalist papers were getting out, and there was no opposition to the people out in the rural parts of the country. If they weren't seeing any anti-Federalist opposition, they thought everybody was for it.
Who said and there was nothing new under the sun?
Exactly. Exactly. And does this remind anybody of the last election? So anyway, the actions of the post office, according to Samuel Bryan, constituted a violation of their duty and integrity and had prostituted their office to forward the nefarious design of enslaving their countrymen by thus cutting off all communication by the usual vehicle between the patriots. So, any thoughts, gentlemen, on how far we've gotten?
You know, I'm just when I was thinking about this topic for tonight, Mike, the book by C.S. Lewis, The Screwtape Letters. David,
oh, yeah.
You read that? I haven't. Well, it's basically written in the voice of a senior devil. And he's writing to his nephew, a novice devil, on how to mess with certain humans' thinking and mind, and basically to distract them and confuse them and to propagandize them. And that's the book. The book is written in the voice of that senior devil giving instruction to this novice devil how to mess with the human mind. And I know when I read the book, The Screwtape Letters, I had to put it down for a while. I read it, a little bit of it, and it was depressing, because it basically highlighted all of the distractions and evil that I could see around me every day. And it was quite depressing. So I found out after that, I finished the book. I went back and finished it. But I found out that C.S. Lewis, when he was writing the book, actually had to stop writing for a time because it depressed him. Because he was bringing out all of what he was seeing in amongst, you know, humans around him and life around him, and how it was so corrupting and so it was depressing. It depressed him when he was writing it, just to even have to think about all of the things that were distracting and corrupting around him. And that's kind of where we're at. It's been going on all along, and things may seem to be new, like the new censorship that's going on, but now that what we're hearing this from the original source documents through Mike, we recognize that this is not new. It's exactly what's been going on all along. We've been in the middle of a spiritual battle since we were born. But because of all the propaganda out there, it's been covered up, and they've controlled the information flow, first through newspapers now, and then through movies, and now through internet. You know, I mean, it's been there all along. And it's difficult to think about this on a daily basis, because it really zaps your energy. If you really try to focus on it and understand it. Any comment about that, Mike?
Well, I think that is a very good assessment, Terry. And one of the things, and this comes from actually one of my lessons that I wrote last year. And here is a question that I had. I would like for you gentlemen to give me an answer to this question that I pose. And that is, if the form of government the self-named Federalist sought to bring to the people of the United States was one of liberty, freedom, and adherence to the principles of the Declaration of Independence, why did they make the proceedings in Philadelphia secret and swear an oath to each other not to discuss the proceedings of that convention for 50 years?
Sounds like an admission of guilt to me.
Your thoughts, Dave?
Well, it's interesting, the number 50 years, too, because I think, wasn't that how long the Kennedy assassination records were sealed for, 50 years?
And Martin Luther King's
interesting
as well.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, Mike, I just, one other thought came to my mind. You talked about the threats of violence against the mob, violence against the papers that printed articles that were in opposition to the Constitution. I wonder why there were no threats of mob violence against papers who printed pro-Constitution articles. That's just something to ask yourself.
Very good point. And also, one thing I didn't want to get through this program without mentioning this, also the false printings that were made, and I almost forgot to bring this up. In several of these newspapers, it was printed with no refutation whatsoever that Patrick Henry fully supported the Constitution, which was an abject lie. but they put it in the papers and they allowed no opposing viewpoints. So there were plenty of people who thought in Philadelphia, Boston, and other places, this guy who stood so firm for the Stamp Act supports this Constitution. And nothing could have been further from the truth with Patrick Henry. No one opposed the Constitution more than he did, possibly with the exception of Samuel Bryan and Luther Martin, who were right in the same league, but they certainly weren't as vocal as Patrick Henry was. So they actually published another false article and claimed it was from Daniel Shays. And Shays, remember now, Shays had been criticized for leading this rebellion, which was, you know, and it had all been printed out of proportion about what the rebellion was actually about, still is to this day, printed a false report on why these people rebelled against the taxes in Massachusetts. But they printed papers that was allegedly from Daniel Shays praising the people who opposed the Constitution. So that would be today, you know, like if someone was running for office and you wanted to make them look bad, you would say, oh, well, you know, gosh, they got letters from Jeffrey Epstein. So we have the dynamic being played that we've all mentioned about, you know, 12 of 91 newspapers, the postmaster general changing the way to stop the flow of anti-federalist newspapers. And now we have also false allegations put into newspapers with no refutation whatsoever. And that's exactly what we have today. Do you see anybody on TV, mainstream TV, on any of these any of these things you can see on the lobotomy box? Do you see anyone with an opposing viewpoint on those stations? Is there anyone out there opposing Fauci and his nutty stuff?
Not on the major channels. And what opposition you do see is not real. It's like the opposing view is not really an opposing view. It's just something a little different to make it look like it's opposing.
Well, here's the point, gentlemen. I also want to make a valid point to the people. Could it be that the people who did all of this deception to get a new constitution through and ratified, these were the same people who spoke and wrote about how terrible the Articles of Confederation were? Is it possible that that was a lie too?
Well, I would expect it would be. Are you saying you've got evidence to that effect?
Well, there is quite a bit of it. It would take another program to go through that. But one of the other things I wanted to mention when I mentioned Washington before on what historian Gary Wills said, in a letter from George Washington to John Jay in March of 1787, just a little over a month before the Constitutional Convention started, George Washington says in that letter to John Jay that he believes that what they are about to do is illegal. Now, I promise you, you haven't seen that published anywhere or people talking about that on the evening news. But he said he believed that what they were about to do quite possibly was illegal and unconstitutional. On that, gentlemen?
Go ahead, Dave.
No. I'm just sort of thinking about this. Terry, you go ahead.
Well, I got something to read if you guys want me to throw something in here also. When the state of Massachusetts was originally asked to provide delegates to the Constitutional Convention, here is what the Massachusetts legislature said, and I quote, More power in Congress has been the cry from all quarters, but especially of those whose views, not being confined to a government that will best benefit of the people, are extended to one that will afford lucrative employment, civil and military. Such a government is an aristocracy which would require a standing army and a numerous train of pensioners to prop and support its exalted administration, unquote. So how they had to change the public opinion. They had to get this changed, and they had to lie about the Articles of Confederation. Because if you would have told the truth about the Articles of Confederation, no one would have supported a new convention.
Well, that's where we're at today. I mean, everybody's getting a false narrative out of the information flow that the majority of people have or are seeing and hearing, and it's all lies.
Well, that's exactly the point I wanted to do with this program tonight, Terry. That's the bottom line. I wanted to show that things have not changed, that we got this Constitution, and it was made out. It was a revolution in favor of government, and it was made based on lies. So, and today is no different. This mask mandate, all of this stuff is based on lies. The pandemic is based on lies. The election was based on lies. Almost everything the government does today is based on lies. But it's not new, because our Constitution itself is based on lies.
Well,
gosh, guys,
Dave, does that make you feel like jumping up and down and having a party?
Well, no. Well, it really does. You know, what's so interesting about all this is it really traces the origin of the problem as to how we got here today, and you know, it really brings the whole conversation full circle.
How do we get rid of this false information flow? How do we even try to challenge this false narrative that is propagated everywhere through every major channel of information, all the way down to our local newspaper?
You gotta get people smart enough not to believe it. That's the only way, because it's always going to be out there. It's the trick of deception. You have to have a people so educated that they won't fall for the same damn trick over and over and over again. I mean, we fell for the false narrative about the Vietnam War. We fell for the false narrative about the school shootings. We fell for the false narrative about 9/11. Oklahoma City bombing, you know, all of the throwing the babies out of incubators onto the floor, which was a lie. Governments are propagated on lies. And until you get a people smart enough not to believe them, we're going to have exactly what we have right now.
People make a choice, Mike. People make a choice about not being smart enough, because being smart enough means that you're going to have to face some things that are uncomfortable. It also means that if you really want to go against this, you lose control and recognize that the world around us and what we're participating in are against our Creator. It always comes back to that spiritual battle. In order to face his truths and to understand his truth, I think is the knowledge that we need people to have in order to fight this. And the majority of people are not willing to go there because it really surrenders their what they perceive to be their control over their own comfort.
Well, Terry, I like
that.
That
makes sense.
That makes sense, and it reminds me of a question I asked a very good man in Mena, Arkansas, who was a minister there. And I'll never forget, he and I were having a discussion at the Lum and Abner parade, convention, what have you, in Mena. And we were sitting and talking about the situation, and I said, "Preacher, I got a question." And he said, "Okay, what's that?" And I said, "Well, from my house to here, which is about 21 miles, there are 13 churches that I can see from the road as I come into Mena. And that's 13 churches in 21 miles. That's better than one church every half a mile. And that doesn't count the churches I can't see, which are off the highway." So my question is this: with such a saturation of churches and allegedly such a saturation of Christians, how can our government be this damn corrupt?
Well, that's a whole show. That's a whole show, Mike. I mean, you've got to bring out the Johnson Amendment. You've got to go back to the fact that these preachers are, for the most part, protecting their own little territories. And they don't want to do anything that would slow down their contributions. And those contributions are...
Go ahead. Let's not forget the comment by the great evangelist of the 19th century, Charles Finney, when he said, if you want to find a problem, if you want to understand why you have a corrupt government, if you want to understand why things aren't going right in your country, look in your pulpits.
I believe he was right. And I've done interviews in the past with some great preachers, ministers, who have all said the same thing. John Weaver, Bob McCurry, I'm trying to remember the guy's name in Pennsylvania that passed away a couple of years ago that was one of the leaders in the unregistered churches. You know, the Black Robe Regiment has pretty much failed us, if you will. But that's where a lot of the dissension happened early on. But they managed to squelch that pretty good. Some of that was squelched through the neo-Zionism and Jesuit futurism and dispensationalism. They've distracted people. It's like C.S. Lewis said, Christianity and vegetarianism was one of the things that he brought up as how easily people are distracted away from what's really important and the real truth.
Well, I know this crazy guy, Terry, who wrote an article titled "The Black Regiment is Missing."
I think his name was Rebel Madman.
I think you might be right. Yeah, I think you might be right. That sounds pretty close.
This would be a great topic for a show. I'm sorry, Mike. Go ahead.
No, I just said that I wrote that many years ago. That's probably 18, 19 years ago. And one of the things I remember from that very distinctly is one of the scriptures I quoted was Jeremiah 50, verse 6.
Yeah. Well, and this really would be a great topic for an entire show or several shows. And I think, you know, one big factor that we can't leave out is the 501c3 status they've given the churches, which is really just a bribe in a way to prevent churches from addressing anything political.
Well, there's no doubt about that. And then if you will remember, what was it, 10, 12 years ago when they actually shut down a church in Indiana for not supporting government positions?
Wow.
Well, I hope you guys get a chance.
Did you say Jeremiah 50 verse 6?
Yes.
My people have been wandering sheep. Their shepherds have led them astray, turning them away on the mountains. They have gone from mountain to hill. They have forgotten their resting place. That one?
Yep, that's it. Does that make sense, Terry?
Oh, yeah. We got 1 minute. Mike, you want to wrap this up?
Well, I'd like to thank everyone for taking the time to listen. I hope you will join Cal Robbins, Neil Ross, Dave Scorpio, and myself tomorrow as we do on Revolution Radio Studio A, as we do a program titled, Was the Constitution a Compact with the States?
Well, that's on Friday?
That's tomorrow, yes, at 12 noon to 2 p.m.
Eastern time.
Mm-hmm.
What are you doing Saturday, Dave?
Well, I'm going to have E. Michael Jones on for 1 hour on the show, and then I think I'm going to have a conversation with Casey Whalen up in Idaho and get some information about what's happening in Idaho. And, Tara, I'd just like to thank you for inviting me on to the show with you and Mike. It's been an honor and a great conversation. Thank you.
Well, you're always welcome, and you always contribute greatly. Appreciate you a lot. And, Mike, what about Sunday night for Addicted to Your Own Destruction?
Sunday night, I've got my wingman, DW, the commercial airline pilot. We are going to, with Dave, my producer, we're going to continue to delve into the deep state in America. We might do a year's worth of classes on this.
Good. Well, gentlemen, thanks for being here tonight, and it is always a pleasure, and we'll be back next Thursday night with Handling the Truth. Now, Mike, you want to just give a teaser about next Thursday night?
Well, next Thursday night is going to be fun because I'm going to have my son, Christopher, on, and we are going to take on two subjects, and that is the terribly flawed federal investigation into racism at the Virginia Military Institute, and we are also going to go into some inside sources on how the new Secretary of Defense is going to purge us, the military, of the white supremacists.
I'm looking forward to that one. Have a good night, everyone. Thanks again, guys.
Hey, good night.
Yeah, good night. Thank you.
All your life, you're only waiting for this moment to arrive. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see. All your life you were only waiting for this moment to be free. Blackbird fly, blackbird fly, into the light of a dark black night. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly. All your life you're only waiting for this moment to arise. Blackbird fly, blackbird fly, into the light of the dark black night. Well, blackbird singing in the dead of night, won't you take these sunken eyes and learn to see. All your life you're only waiting for this moment to be free.